Now one more embrace. Eva clutched her little valise and her violin, and together they boarded the train, promising to send word as soon as they arrived in Rome.
They will be all right. They have nothing to worry about,
Angelo said softly. He didn't say, now that you're gone, but Eva heard the words anyway. Those who sheltered Jews would not be safe now that the Germans were in charge.
This is your pass.
He handed her a document, and she took it, confused.
I have a pass, Angelo.
A priest would not be traveling alone with a young woman he is not related to. You are my sister now. See?
He tapped the document she was holding, and she looked down at it. It looked completely authentic, from the different stamps to the emblem on the front to the type inside. And Eva would know. She'd been helping Aldo make false papers since her father had gone to Austria and never come home again.
But her name was now Eva Bianco, and she was not a Jew.
How?
Aldo, he said briefly. I asked him to make it a while back, just in case.
I'm from Naples, she asked,
her voice pitched for his ears only.
No one will give the Germans any information they seek south of the Allied line. They have no way to verify you aren't who you say you are.
Except I don't speak with a Neapolitan dialect.
A German won't be able to tell. You speak Italian, they don't. And if they do, you can fake it. You've always had a great ear. And the German won't be nearly discerning enough to distinguish dialect.
Their hushed conversation ended abruptly when a couple with a child entered the compartment and sat across from them. A heavy-set man followed a few minutes later and sat on Angelo's right. Unless they wanted to discuss inanities, which was far too much work, they wouldn't be talking much on the trip. It was better that way. Eva didn't need to talk to Angelo. She didn't need Angelo at all. She was going to see her Uncle Augusto as soon as they arrived, and she had every intention of moving in with him, Aunt Bianca, Claudia, and Levi. She would stay with them until the Germans left Italy. She would assist Angelo in refugee work where she could. She had grown adept as a printer's apprentice if he could find her a press. But she wasn't going to hide in a convent, as Angelo had suggested the night before. The first hours of their journey passed without incident. But at the station in Chiusi, several German officers boarded the train with a civilian translator wearing a black armband, signifying his fascist affiliations.
"Documenti!"
the civilian shouted, and people started to scramble for their papers. Eva's palms grew damp and her breaths short. There was always a first time for a false pass. And this was hers. Aldo had always told her his documents were without equal. She would know soon enough. Angelo seemed completely at ease, and when the German approached and demanded their passes, Angelo bowed his head in a priestly fashion and placed his in the officer's hand. The German looked at Angelo's pass for what seemed an eternity. He talked quietly to the Italian interpreter. And though Eva spoke fluent German, she couldn't hear what he said. Finally, he leveled pale, suspicious eyes on Angelo, who did not seem at all alarmed by the scrutiny. Then he looked at Eva sitting next to Angelo, and his eyes narrowed further. He stuck his palm in front of her face.
Papers.
She placed her identity card in his hand, the one Angelo had given her only hours before. The German eyed the document with the same suspicion.
Bianco, eh? Interesting. Her name is the same as yours.
He looked at Angelo. His companion rushed to translate.
She is my sister.
Angelo lied calmly. He was a very good liar, Eva thought.
Sie ist meine Schwester,
the translator repeated.
I do not think this is your sister. I think this is your wife,
the German said. The translator rushed to spit out the words they already understood.
For all I know, you are a deserter,
he continued. An Italian coward, a soldier running from your responsibilities. I do not think you are a priest.
She is my sister, and I am a priest, not a soldier, not a deserter.
Angelo pulled up his cassock and tapped his prosthetic, drawing the attention of the German inspector.
I was never a soldier. Men with one leg do better as priests.
Convinced but not happy about it, the soldier handed back their papers with a huff and moved on to his next victims. He'd been so intent on Angelo, he'd hardly looked twice at Ava's pass, other than to pounce on her name. Ava slid her pass back into her bag and allowed herself to breathe just for a moment. Her eyes slid to Angelo's and he met her gaze, smiling slightly. There was no privacy, no chance to celebrate the tiny victory. But when he tapped his nose, she tugged her ear, an old baseball signal he'd taught her once, and turned her eyes out the window so she wouldn't smile back at him. Ava marveled at the ease with which Angelo bared his prosthetic. It hadn't always been that way. He had made her wait 6 months before he'd shown her his leg. She'd been dying to know, and he'd been reticent to share. In exchange for the privilege of seeing the leg that wasn't there, she had read him confession after confession, journal entry after journal entry, and he had listened like she was the most fascinating person in the world. He hadn't looked at her that way in a very long time. In fact, Angelo tried very hard not to look at her at all. Even now his eyes were trained out the window, watching the countryside streak by, a blur of colors and shapes, the speed erasing the details and the definition, until it looked more like a smeared painting than real life. The way Angelo was now, she could almost believe that the boy he'd been had not been real either. Ava pulled her journal and a pen from her valise and opened it to a blank page, needing to do something to take her eyes from him, to forget him. But instead, she remembered the first time she heard his name. Angelo. Angelo Bianco. White Angel. She had loved him instantly. They had both known loss, that much was true, but Angelo had felt his loss early and he'd felt it keenly. Ava had hardly felt it at all. Maybe that was part of the problem. At an early age, Angelo had learned to let go. Ava's experience came later, and when it did, it came all at once. She hadn't felt her mother's loss when it happened. She felt it more now that she was the only Adler left. Sadly, her mother would always be dying in her memories, and her father would never be dead. That's what happened when you said goodbye to someone, watched them board a train and they never came home. Somewhere inside, you always believed they would come back. Going to Austria had been a fool's errand. She'd known it when she heard her father's plan. He'd reassured her by telling her she would always have Angelo.
You will always have Angelo, he promised me. You will always have Angelo.
He'd been wrong about that, too. Angelo had never been hers, and he never would be. Except for once, for a few hours, in Maremma. The memory brought the same ache it always did.
You're still right in that old thing.
There was a smile in Angelo's voice, and Ava looked up from her fat leather-bound journal. It wasn't the same old book Angelo remembered. She'd filled up four of them, but she'd always picked the same style, as if the style itself gave her life constancy.
Yes, but not very often, obviously, she answered,
closing the book and wrapping the elastic band around it, keeping the pages tight and the book closed. She slid it back into her valise and folded her hands.
Do you still write confessions?
He asked gently.
No,
she lied.
I've decided confessions are only for priests.
She realized how confrontational she sounded, and she shrugged. shaking off her words.
I just write to record events. That's all.
What were you writing about
just now? He pressed, and she found herself glowering at him.
He reached up and smoothed the crease between her brows.
I'm just making conversation, Ava. I'm not interrogating you. Stop glaring at me.
She turned her face away, and his hand fell back to his lap. They sat in silence for several moments until she relented with a sigh.
I was thinking about Maremma, the train ride. It was awful.
She didn't specify which trip.
But we still went. Every year,
he said, smiling. She didn't want him to smile. The flash of white teeth beneath his well-shaped lips made her flinch and look away. It actually hurt when he smiled at her.
I'll never go back, she said tightly.
She closed her eyes so she could pretend to sleep. But instead, she thought about the last time she'd seen the red shingled house with the big veranda, surrounded by forest and sea. The best of both worlds. Camilo's determination to get around the racial laws had been very impressive to Angela. At the time, it had given him a great deal of hope. After the first round of laws were passed in 1938, Camilo had deeded his home to Santino and Fabia, with promises to continue on exactly as they had all done before. He and Ava would pay rent for the two rooms they occupied. That rent was equivalent to what he'd been paying Santino and Fabia as a monthly salary. So nothing changed. Camilo continued to pay all the bills from a household account, and things had all moved forward quite seamlessly. Gino Sotello became sole owner of Ostriga Glass Factory on paper, but the two had written up a contract where nothing changed at all. And they filed the contract with a lawyer in the United States and put a large amount of money in a trust with Angelo's name on it. Angelo was still an American citizen, so it worked. Camilo went to work, but he didn't get paid. If anyone asked, he was just consulting. It required trust. What had Ava said so long ago? Sometimes God works through people. It was true. People were all Camilo Rosselli had to work with, and he'd managed to get around the laws just like he said he would, trusting the people closest to him. He'd made all the right moves until he'd made the wrong one. Angelo knew Ava wasn't sleeping, though the rhythm and vibration of the Rome-bound train was making him a little drowsy. Ava was trying to keep him at a distance. She'd mentioned Maremma and retreated into herself. He could hardly blame her. It had the same effect on him, and his memories of Maremma weren't nearly as long and complicated. He was surprised Ava had mentioned it at all. It had been devastating, the way it all ended. When he was younger, he would stay for the full month of August, just like the rest of the family. But as he grew older and his studies intensified, an entire month just wasn't feasible. Plus, as much as he loved his family and the seashore, 3 weeks of sun, sand, and Ava's beauty weren't healthy for a young seminarian, regardless of whether or not they called themselves cousins. But his nonna would beg and plead and cajole, and he would inevitably show up, if only for a few days. Angelo loved the beaches of Maremma. It was a place filled with memories bathed in warmth and washed in white. White sand, white shells, white towels, and the white sundress Ava had worn that long-ago summer when he'd received his first kiss. It was Ava's first kiss, too, though he was pretty sure she'd received plenty since then. Ava had convinced him that they needed to see what all the fuss was about. She was 12 that summer, and he was 14, still too young and far away from the priesthood to worry about his immortal soul if he kissed a signoria. Ava's suggestion had seemed logical, enticing even, and he had shrugged and let her pull his face to hers. Her lips were soft, but his were sandy, and she had wrinkled her nose and laughed when their mouths touched.
"That tickles."
She brushed at his lips, and they tried again, but neither of them closed their eyes. They stared at each other, even when they were too close to see anything but eyelashes and freckles. They stayed frozen, lips touching, until Ava started to laugh again. Angelo pulled away and scrubbed at his mouth, embarrassed.
"I think we're doing it wrong," he muttered.
"Really?"
Ava frowned, her laughter fading.
"What else should we be doing?"
"Well, for one, you could close your eyes."
"But you didn't close yours,"
she argued.
"I'll close mine, too."
"Okay. What else?"
He had a pretty good idea that kisses involved tongues. He wasn't sure how, as that seemed extremely wet and a little disgusting, but he thought he would try just a tentative stroke. He wouldn't tell Ava it was coming. Then, if it didn't work, he could claim the attempt was inadvertent.
"Tip your head so we don't bonk noses," he instructed.
"Okay. And come closer so we aren't stretching," she suggested.
They tried again, and he made sure there was no sand on his lips. They leaned in and simultaneously closed their eyes, tilting their heads instinctively. It was much better, especially because Ava wasn't laughing. Angelo's tongue tiptoed out and touched her top lip. She tasted like sunshine and grapes. She stiffened in surprise but didn't pull away, and his hands fisted handfuls of sand as her tongue hesitantly returned the caress. Then his tongue was touching hers, and her grape and sunshine flavor was in his mouth and tickling his nose, and his eyes were rolling back in his head, completely drunk on sensation. That was when his nonna discovered them. She shrieked their names and swatted them both on the heads, crossing herself and praying between the slaps. They were grounded from each other for 2 days, and Camillo sat them both down for a serious talk. When he was finished with his strange rambling lecture about men and women and babies and kissing, Ava just laughed and bounced up from her seat. She placed herself in her father's lap and looked him in the eye, her face deadly serious.
"Babu, it was disgusting. It was like kissing an oyster. I never want to kiss another boy for as long as I live."
"It was?"
Angelo interjected, stunned that the experience had been so very different for him.
"You don't?"
Camillo looked as shocked as Angelo felt.
"No, it was a silly dare. Angelo is like my brother. I am his sister. It will never happen again, Babo. Don't worry. Now, please, I need my friend back. I don't want to spend my holiday all by myself."
"Angelo?"
Camillo was looking at him, his eyebrows raised.
"Huh?"
He was completely lost, and his feelings were more than a little bruised.
"Was kissing Ava like kissing an oyster?"
Camillo pressed. Angelo's eyes darted between Ava's face and Camillo's spectacled gaze, then back again. He always tried to tell the truth, especially to Camillo. Should he tell him it was nothing like kissing an oyster? Should he tell him it was the most amazing 15 seconds of his life? Ava had widened her eyes comically and tilted her head, giving Angelo a look that said, "Play along, you idiot."
"Oh. Oh. Yeah. Maybe not like an oyster, but it was slimy and a little disgusting. Like kissing Nonna, maybe."
Angelo lied. Ava laughed, not offended in the slightest. Camillo narrowed his eyes at his daughter, and she grabbed his face and kissed his cheeks.
"Don't worry, Babbo. Angelo is my brother. Now may we please go to the beach?
The memory made Angelo smile.
Ava had been devious and oh so convincing. Camillo had sighed and off they had gone. But they weren't left alone again, even once, for the rest of the summer.
And there was no more kissing. It was as if a decision had been made. The response of their elders had made the pathway clear. If they wanted to remain in each other's lives, kissing was not an option. They had never talked about it, never admitted to each other that it was a beautiful first, a precious memory. But for years afterward, they couldn't mention oysters without grinning at each other. And when they did, Ava would get a look in her eyes. She got a look in her eyes, and Angelo got a pain in his chest. He rubbed his hand over his heart, absent-mindedly easing the old ache. His hand found his cross, and he traced it, closing his eyes and trying to say his midday prayers. But the sway of the train and the shape of the girl beside him made his mind flit away back to white beaches and forbidden kisses.
Chapter 9. The Church of Santa Cecilia. A gong sounded and a whistle blew, and Angelo woke with a start. They were in Rome. He'd fallen asleep after all. Ava had too, and her head was tucked against his shoulder, as if she'd tried to prop it up against her seat, only to lose the battle to gravity. A surge of tenderness for her had him closing his eyes and asking for strength for the umpteenth time since he'd first seen her yesterday. She stirred against his shoulder and pulled away with a jerk. He finished his prayer and stretched his arms, giving her time to compose herself. He straightened his collar and ran his hands over his closely cropped curls. As long as he kept them short, the waves conformed to the shape of his head, keeping the curl relatively tame, before placing his wide-brimmed black hat on his head.
"We're here," he said gently, finally turning toward her.
She nodded, a quick dip of her head, as she repinned her little white hat. She slicked a fresh coat of red across her lips and snapped her handbag closed, tucking it back down inside her small valise. They stood and made their way off the train, the exhaust and bedlam of the station invigorating, even if the September day was still too warm.
"I have a place for you to stay. It's not far from where I live," he said, tossing the words over his shoulder as he wove in and out of the crowd, using his cane to clear a path.
"I'm going to stay with my uncle. I sent a telegram. They're expecting me,"
she called out behind him. He stopped abruptly, and Ava cursed under her breath as she collided with his rigid back. He resumed walking almost immediately, but when they reached the street and set down their luggage, waiting for a bus that could take them across town, he murmured his displeasure into her ear.
"They live in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood."
Ava raised one delicate eyebrow and pursed her lips, waiting for him to continue.
"Living with a Jewish family is the most foolish thing you can do. You might as well wear a star on your chest."
"Are you saying they're in danger?"
she murmured, keeping her voice as low as his.
"Yes, Ava. That's exactly what I'm saying."
He shook his head, incredulous.
"Staying with your uncle will completely undermine the whole reason I wanted you to come to Rome. A place where you aren't known. A place where your name, your address, and your religion isn't on some fascist list, easily accessed by the SS. A place where no one can point you out."
"I want to see them, Angelo. I haven't seen them in 2 years.
The bus pulled up, and Angelo moved toward it, still tugging her suitcase and his much smaller bag.
"This is our bus," he said,
though she had no idea what that meant or where it went. They boarded, sliding into a seat near the front, stowing their bags on a rack above their heads. When the bus lurched and groaned and eventually resumed its route, Ava tried to find out.
"Where do you live?"
I am not far from your uncle. I live on the west side of the Tiber, near the Basilica di Santa Maria. Eva had no idea where that was. His landmarks were meaningless to her.
Do you live with other priests?
I live in an apartment with Monsignor Luciano and his older sister, a lovely old woman who spends her days making lace when she's not playing housekeeper. She likes to pretend I'm her son. She takes very good care of both of us.
I thought you lived in a rectory. Isn't that what a priest's home is called?
I used to. After I was ordained, I served in a village just south of Rome for about 6 months, before I was assigned as a curate at the Church of the Sacred Heart east of Trastevere, not far from the Colosseum.
A curate?
An assistant to the parish priest. I served there for 2 years. In that time, I got to know the area very well.
And now?
Now my duties have changed.
You don't conduct mass every day.
She had always imagined him feeding wafers to open-mouthed parishioners and giving long sermons. She realized suddenly how little she really knew about Angelo's daily life.
I attend mass every day, several times if my duties allow it. But no, I am an assistant to Monsignor Luciano, who is a senior official with the Roman Curia.
What is the Roman Curia?
It is the administrative arm of the Catholic Church.
You work in an office?
She was stunned.
Yes, I do. When I'm not running all over the city, I work in an office in the Vatican. It is a busy time for my department. It will only get busier.
What is your department?
Migrant assistance.
She stared at him, bemused.
There is such a department.
In a manner of speaking, yes. The official description is to promote pastoral assistance to migrants, nomads, tourists, and travelers. The congregation is overseen by a cardinal. Monsignor Luciano serves Cardinal Dubois. I assist Monsignor Luciano. My job is to attend the Monsignor in whatever duties he assigns, but I rarely sit at the desk and type, if that's what you're thinking. There are lay secretaries and assistants to do that. I tend to be the physical liaison, and I mostly do legwork.
How interesting. A one-legged priest doing legwork.
Yes, ironic.
He smirked, and his blue eyes glinted. She didn't smile even though she wanted to. It was too easy to fall back into their old ways, poking at each other and teasing one another. It wouldn't be good for her. It would make her miss him too much when she returned to Florence. She resolved to guard herself against him even as he spoke again, the humor absent from his voice.
I want you to stay at the Santa Cecilia. It's a cloistered convent, but there are rooms available for boarders along the entrance block. It's in Trastevere, and you won't be too far from your family.
He sounded as if he were giving an order, dictating what she would do, and she opened her mouth to refuse.
Please, Eva.
He implored so softly that she could almost pretend it didn't happen.
I don't want to be alone,
she murmured, hating herself for her vulnerability.
Better alone than arrested,
he said. But his eyes were compassionate.
I'm not sure that's true, Angelo,
she answered.
I'm not sure of that at all.
Eva, he sighed. You don't mean that.
How do you know, Angelo?
She asked sharply.
How can you possibly claim to know how I feel?
He shot her a look that said he knew exactly how she felt, and she turned away with a shake of her head, dismissing him. He knew nothing.
I told my family I was coming, she reiterated. They are expecting me. I'm sure they would like to see you, too.
Angelo started to shake his head, anger tightening his mouth and causing the groove between his eyes to deepen into a canyon.
I will see them. We will have dinner with them, and then you can lock me in the convent if you must,
she added before he could resume his campaign. Angelo exhaled with relief, and the rest of the ride was spent in stony contemplation. They had to change buses and catch another before taking a streetcar that let them off 2 blocks from 325 Viale Domina. It was 2 in the afternoon, and they'd been traveling since 6 o'clock that morning. Angelo looked remarkably unwilted, his black cassock and wide-brimmed hat traveling much better than Ava's slim red skirt and white blouse. She felt filthy and wrinkled, and she removed her hat so she could smooth her hair as they waited for someone to answer the door. The building was neat and clean, the corridors wide and airy, but the residence was a decided step down from Uncle Augusto's Florence home, which was now being rented to non-Jews for a ridiculously small amount of money. The door opened an inch, and a brown eye appeared in the gap.
"Ava! Angelo!"
The door was flung open, and Ava's cousin, Claudia, decidedly less plump than she'd once been, war rations were only good for one thing, pulled Ava into the small parlor, reaching out a hand for Angelo as well. Ava took quick note of the polished floors, the pictures on the walls, and the pieces of furniture from their home in Florence. The homey atmosphere and the effort to make the apartment comfortable eased the knot in Ava's stomach. She had worried about her uncle and aunt, about her cousins and their life in Rome. From the looks of it, all was well.
"We've been waiting to eat. Levi got fruit.
He's a black market guru, you know. He manages to get things no one else can."
She prattled easily as she led them into a sitting area, teeming with people.
"Ava, you remember Julia, don't you? Mama's sister."
Julia Sonnino was much younger than her older sister, barely 30 years old if that, and Claudia and Ava had always looked up to her, like a more sophisticated older cousin than an aunt. Julia was still lovely, but she was hugely pregnant, and she smiled wearily at Ava and Angelo and tried to stand to greet them. Her husband, Mario, pressed her right back down into the sofa and stood in her stead. Mario Sonnino was a physician, a tall, slender man with kind eyes, a Jewish trait, according to her father.
"We Jews have kind eyes and quick minds," he would say.
Ava didn't know if it was true.
Camillo had claimed so many things as Jewish traits, but Mario reminded Ava a little of her babbo, so maybe he was right.
Ava had attended Mario and Julia's wedding when she was 12 or 13, and she and Claudia had thought Mario very good-looking. Plus, he played the violin, which made him a kindred spirit from the start. He wasn't especially handsome. Ava could see that now. But he wore goodness all over his face, and he was clearly devoted to his wife. Ava smiled at him warmly and shook hands with the little girl who hung on to his leg and dimpled winsomely when she was introduced.
"This is Emilia,"
Mario said.
"And the boy who is determined to beat Levi at chess is our oldest, Lorenzo."
Lorenzo, a little boy of about 8 or 9 and missing his 2 front teeth, heard his name and grinned, lifting his head from the chessboard in front of him. Levi stood from the game and approached Ava and Angelo in 3 long strides, swooping Ava up in a huge hug that had her laughing and little Emilia squealing and begging for a turn.
"Me, me, swing me, Cousin Levi."
"Yes, swing Emilia,"
Ava laughed as he set her down. Levi shook hands with Angelo. Then Aunt Bianca started ushering them to the dinner table, where prayer was offered to a nonspecific god, and the meal was quickly consumed. The conversation volleyed from one topic to the next, the time apart requiring a great deal of catch-up. When Angelo stepped in to field some questions, Ava turned to Julia to inquire about her pregnancy.
"When is the baby due?"
"We have a month,"
Julia sighed, as if a month was an eternity.
"I'm very ready now. though our circumstances aren't the best. Do you live here in the building?
No, we are in the old ghetto,
she answered quietly.
Mario's a doctor, but he lost his practice.
We had a home in Perugia.
Her voice faded off, and Eva didn't pursue the subject.
Will you be staying here with Augusto and Bianca?
Julia asked politely, shifting the focus to Eva.
I'm not sure,
Eva hedged, not wanting to start a possibly uncomfortable conversation. Of course, her answer didn't go unchallenged.
What do you mean?
Claudia chirped from across the table.
Of course you are. You will stay in my room.
I've made arrangements for Eva,
Angelo interjected, and Claudia immediately frowned.
But why?
Eva will stay here,
Uncle Augusto said, as if his was the final word on the subject.
It's not safe,
Angelo said quietly.
It's not safe for any of you, honestly. You need to change apartments, Augusto. Or leave Rome.
But Rome is the safest place for Jews. The Germans have been on their best behavior. We'll be fine here. Your Pope is our best defense. The Germans don't want an international public relations problem with the Vatican. One in three Germans is Catholic. Did you know that, Angelo? That's why I brought my family here.
The Pope is in an impossible position. He holds no power over Hitler. He couldn't save the Jews in Germany. He couldn't save the Jews in Poland. He couldn't save the Jews in Austria. He won't be able to save the Jews in Rome.
The table went silent, and Eva winced. Angelo put down his fork and stared at Augusto soberly.
If you won't hide, that is your choice. But Eva won't be staying here.
He lowered his voice, as if the walls had ears.
At the very least, let me get you false documents that you can use if the Germans do come knocking.
Like the documents Camillo used. Documents like that,
Augusto retorted, pushing his chair back from the table in disgust. He didn't rise, but he leveled a finger at Angelo.
My brother pretended to be someone he was not. They caught him. And now my brother is gone.
A week after Camillo Rosselli went to Austria to find Otto Adler, the Italian police had shown up at the Ostriga glass factory in Florence, asking questions. The Gestapo had contacted them. Camillo had been recognized in Vienna by someone who knew he was Jewish and knew he was not the person he was claiming to be. He was claiming to be Gino Sotello, his non-Jewish partner at the glass factory. Camillo would have been far better off with his own papers. An Italian Jew was safer than a man with false papers. Gino Sotello had pled ignorance and innocence, and they'd believed him, only because Camillo Rosselli had claimed he'd stolen the pass, unbeknownst to his old partner. It was a lie. Gino had known everything. But it saved Gino from charges, and it saved Camillo from having to tell authorities it was a fake pass, protecting the forging operation that was ongoing at Ostriga. It didn't save Gino from having to tell Eva that her father had been arrested. He had arrived at the villa, his hat in his hands, his face gray, and told Eva that her father was not going to be coming home anytime soon. The only information police could give Gino Sotello was that Camillo Rosselli had been sent, along with other Jewish detainees, to a labor camp called Auschwitz.
3 years ago,
Augusto held up three fingers, underlining his words. And we've had no word.
I won't do it. I won't do anything to endanger my family. No fake papers.
He slapped the dinner table. And little Emilia stuck out her lip at the sound, as if she'd been slapped too.
That's your choice, Angelo repeated. But Eva isn't staying here.
Eva bit back her irritation. She didn't like being discussed as if she weren't there to speak for herself. But she remained silent.
Uncle Augusto had always been too quick to choose optimism. Optimism could get you killed. They remained an hour longer, but the days were growing shorter, and a new curfew had been announced with the arrival of the Germans. Mario Sonnino followed Angelo and Eva to the door and walked with them to the street, chatting amiably. But when they moved to leave, he touched Angelo's arm, halting him.
"I want documents," he whispered, "for my family. As soon as the baby is born, we are leaving Rome. Can you help me?"
Eva and Angelo both nodded, and Eva gripped his hand.
"It may take a few weeks, and if Angelo can't help you, I will."
Angelo shot Eva a cautionary glare, but he didn't argue with her. Not there. Mario nodded gratefully.
"Thank you. Thank you both."
He scribbled his number and his address on a scrap of paper and handed it to Angelo.
"Eva,"
Mario stopped her as she turned away.
"Yes."
"Don't come back here,"
he murmured.
"The padre is right."
The distance to the church of Santa Cecilia was relatively short, and within 15 minutes, Angelo was leading Eva toward a stately, gated edifice tucked at the far end of a cobbled piazza. There were hundreds of churches in Rome, big and small, ornate and old, famous and obscure. But the arched entrance of the Santa Cecilia was quietly welcoming as Angelo led Eva beyond the tall gate into a courtyard lined with roses and benches. A rectangular pool with a large vase at the center encouraged quiet conversation and meditation, though the space was completely empty. Rows of windows overlooked the courtyard on each side. Several stories that made up the convent on one side and an ancient bathhouse on the other. Angelo said the church was named for Cecilia, a noblewoman who was locked in her bathhouse for 3 days, a murder attempt, only to come out unscathed and singing. The bathhouse had been turned into a chapel, and Cecilia had since become a patron saint of music. Eva tried to imagine what a bathhouse chapel looked like, and determined that she would sneak inside at some point if the nuns refused to show her. They walked into the nave, looking for the abbess, and found it as empty and silent as the courtyard. The nave was rather gray and depressing, the arch of the ceiling too low for transcendence. But the statue of a woman beneath the altar made up for it. The sculpture was unlike any Eva had ever seen before. It was lifelike and lovely, yet so forlorn. The woman appeared as if she were sleeping, but her face was turned into the ground, strands of hair obscuring her profile, and the gash on her neck told a different story.
"Is this Saint Cecilia? What happened to her?"
Eva asked, her eyes clinging to the slim white column of the woman's throat.
"After failing to kill her in the bathhouse, they attempted again. They tried to behead her."
"Tried?"
"The legend is that 3 blows with an axe did not accomplish the task. She died slowly, converting many in the process,"
Angelo answered.
"What was her crime?"
Eva asked, unable to look away from the statue.
"It was politics. She was an outspoken woman,"
Angelo said wryly, as if he thought Eva could relate. There was a smile in his voice, but Eva couldn't smile. She could only stare at the martyred saint.
"Oh, Father Bianco, we expected you much sooner,"
a woman called out in surprise, distracting Angelo from his response. Eva turned toward the voice and watched as a diminutive woman with sagging jowls and sharp eyes approached them at a speed that belied her age. She entered the nave through a door to the left of the apse.
"Mother Francesca, this is Eva,"
Angelo said simply, as if he'd already told the ancient nun all about her.
"You'd best be off, Father,"
the abbess directed.
"There is trouble with the Holy Sisters of Adoration. A pilgrim has died, and there is some disagreement about what should be done. I will check on you tomorrow, Eva, Angelo said, and with a quick bow toward the abbess, he was striding back toward the entrance, cane tapping, his small suitcase swinging. Eva could only stare after him, wondering again why she'd agreed to come to Rome. Come, Mother Francesca commanded, and without waiting to see if Eva was coming, followed Angelo out of the nave and through the courtyard. Eva grabbed the large suitcase Angelo had carried all day, and juggling her valise and violin in her other hand, struggled to catch up. The nun led her through a small door to the left of the entrance wall. As they ascended a narrow staircase, the nun offered some information.
The convent is shared between the Benedictine nuns and the Franciscan missionary sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. But we are smaller in numbers than we once were, and the convent is past its prime.
Eva wondered how long it had been past its prime. 200 years? 3?
These rooms were used for lay staff, but we have no use for a large staff anymore. We have both a cloistered community as well as nuns who serve in an active apostolate beyond these walls. We use these rooms for boarders. The little bit of income is much needed, especially now.
Eva nodded, wondering how long the sack of banknotes she'd brought with her would last. The value kept falling. Before long, they would be more useful as toilet paper. The jewelry she brought would get her a little further. The abbess opened a door and stepped aside. The room contained a narrow mattress on a metal frame, a wooden cross nailed to the wall above it. A simple chair, a chest of drawers, and a small closet lined the opposite wall. Mother Francesca flipped on the desk lamp, indicating this was home.
This is your room, washroom at the end of the hall. It is for shared use, but you are the only boarder here at the moment. A luxury. Vespers at 6. You are expected to attend.
But I am not Catholic, Eva protested.
You are now.
18 September, 1943. Confession. I don't like nuns. I am tired, but sleep is as elusive as Angelo has always been. The convent is too quiet, and it smells old. Why is it that all of Rome smells so old? Or maybe it is just me, and I can't get the scent of loss from my skin. I feel as ancient and crumbling as the walls of the old temple the bus trundled past today. But at least the temple doesn't have to hide. I've been here less than 12 hours, and I miss Florence so desperately I want to start walking. Florence smells like flowers. It smells like jasmine and Fabia and my father's pipe. After all these years, I can still smell him in the rooms of the villa, and I am both comforted and tortured by the scent. I'm lying in a little bed in a strange room, listening to the walls say nothing. I tried to play my violin, but the echo in the room made my skin crawl, like I was the Pied Piper of dead nuns. I didn't want to summon ghosts or rats, so I put my violin away. I went to Vespers as instructed and watched the nuns sing and an old priest conduct the service. There were more nuns behind a little opening on the other side of the apse. They never come out, apparently. I wonder if that's what Angelo wants for me. Maybe he thinks I can just hide in this little convent until the war is over, and then he'll pat himself on the back because he saved me. What am I being saved for? I look ahead at my life, even a life where there is no fear or worry that the Gestapo will swoop me up and send me away, and I can't find the will to be hopeful. Eva Rosselli.
Chapter 10. The Jewish Ghetto. The pilgrim who had passed was an old Jewish woman who had been left behind when her son and his family fled to Genoa. The nuns of the Holy Sisters of Adoration had taken her in, and she'd passed peacefully in her sleep, sitting in front of a window in a white wimple and a borrowed black veil, looking like one of the nuns who hid her. Angelo promised the abbess to pay a visit to the rabbi at the main synagogue first thing in the morning, to see if clandestine funeral arrangements could be made. Otherwise, they would be burying her among nuns with a cross on her grave. It was all they could do. She'd died among them. She would be buried among them, too. Maybe when the war was over, they could remove the cross and put a Star of David in its place. And maybe they could restore her name. Maybe someday her family would return and lay stones on her grave, the way Ava used to do for ancestors she never even knew. But the odds were that Regina Ravenna would be hidden in the ground under a false name and a meaningless cross. And no one but the Holy Sisters of Adoration and Angelo would ever be the wiser. The knowledge and responsibility weighed on Angelo. He wanted to keep records but didn't dare. He wanted to keep ledgers and lists of names and family members so that he could account for every person he felt responsible for. But records and lists were incriminating. So he'd devised a method to keep it as straight as he could, kept any necessary papers in the Vatican, and prayed that God would preserve his memory so no one would be lost to forgetfulness. He made his way home long after the curfew, but was not stopped, fortunately. He had a pass that allowed him to be out when his duties demanded it. But if he were challenged, he would have to lie about the old woman he'd attended to. And the old woman was a paperless Jew. The last year or two had been one lie after another. Sometimes he missed the simple little village where he'd spent the first 6 months of his life as a priest. Eat, pray, sleep, serve. That was all he did. Plus, the streets were so narrow, and the road to the village so winding and steep, it was unlikely the Germans could send in their tanks without getting them lodged between buildings. Then he was called to Rome, and he'd gotten a crash course in service and survival on the streets of the Eternal City. Then Monsignor Luciano, his sponsor of sorts, the man who had kept an eye on him for so many years, brought him in to assist him at the Curia, a totally different kind of experience. At the Curia, he'd met Monsignor O'Flaherty, an Irish priest at the Vatican who was deeply involved in refugee work. And Angelo's doubled life had begun. He'd begun traveling from one end of the city to the next. Every church, every monastery, every convent, and every college. And he'd made note of numbers, rooms, availability, and access. And the people had started to come. A Jewish mother needed to hide her sons. A rabbi, fearing he was a target but unwilling to leave his congregation, still wanted to protect his family. The word had spread, and people came. The church was now in the business of hide-and-seek, and Angelo was the eyes and ears, a young priest with a limp and an affinity for languages, with a special understanding of the Jewish people. He understood their dietary needs and their worship practices, and he was just another cog in the wheel of clergy who had begun the enormous task of trying to hide the hunted. They'd started with foreign Jews who had been ordered to leave Italy in 1940, but had nowhere to go, just like Felix. But since July, the tide had turned, and with the fall of bombs and dictators, the church was hiding Italians. The Monsignor instructed him to find alternative methods of hiding refugees, and Angelo remembered Aldo Finzi. He made a trip to Florence and asked the little man to help him. Together, they'd distributed over 200 passes to Jews who could hide in plain sight if they had the right paperwork. This made room for the Jews who couldn't blend in due to language or physical appearance. It was harder to hide the Jewish men. They couldn't just pretend to be non-Jewish Italians and be absorbed into the populace. Young Italian men of a fighting age were expected to be doing just that, fighting. Soldiers had to hide from the Germans, too. And there were so many children. They had 3 convents throughout the city that were full of Jewish orphans. Some of them could be placed with families, but children presented a specific danger. All it would take was one wrong word, a forgetful comment, and the child, along with the family that sheltered him, would be exposed. They'd branched out into the countryside, but transporting them was difficult, too. The whole operation was difficult and made more challenging every day. Angelo wasn't working alone. There were hundreds of fathers and sisters, monks and nuns, opening their doors and closing their eyes to the danger all around them. But sometimes Angelo felt incredibly alone. It was safer not to share, safer not to confide, safer to handle as much as he could without involving anyone else. And he was tired. That night, he fell into bed after hasty prayers, his leg aching, feeling wearier than he'd ever felt. But his mind kept returning to Ava. She'd watched him leave the chapel without protest, her face blank, gripping her violin like it was all she cared about in the world, and he'd walked away without looking back. He'd had to. She was safe, and he was needed elsewhere. But it reminded him too much of August of 1939, when he'd walked away and left her in the Pazzi Chapel. They'd come back from Maremma, back to reality, with a new knowledge of each other and of the world they found themselves in. Angelo had known what he had to do, and he'd done it. But the memory haunted him still. On September 26th, less than 10 days after Ava moved in with the sisters at Santa Cecilia, Lieutenant Colonel Kapler, the head of the German SS in Rome, demanded 50 kilograms of gold be delivered to German headquarters on Via Tasso. If the Jewish community failed to do so within 36 hours, 200 of Rome's Jews would be rounded up and deported. Lines of Jews formed outside the main synagogue on Lungo Tevere de Ceni, desperate people donating all they had to keep the dragon at bay. Angelo forbade Ava from going anywhere near the synagogue, but she ignored him, taking every piece of gold jewelry she'd brought to Rome and waiting in line to add her offering to the pile. Uncle Augusto was among the elders assisting with the weighing and the counting, and when he saw Ava, he assured her once more that the extortion was a good sign.
"The Germans are logical men. Taking our gold makes much more sense than taking our people," he said.
Ava could only shake her head. Nothing about the Jewish persecution was logical or rational. But she gave her gold with a glimmer of hope that it was exactly as her uncle said. Ava was leaving the synagogue when she saw Mario and Giulia Sonnino standing in line with their 2 children. Giulia was so hugely pregnant that Ava convinced those waiting in front of her in the line to let her move ahead so she wouldn't have to stand for hours. The Soninos donated their wedding rings and a Swiss pocket watch that had been in Mario's family for 3 generations. Giulia joked that the thin white line on her finger was proof enough that she wasn't a loose woman. But there were tears in her eyes when she left her thick gold band on the pile. Ava waited with their children until they were finished, and walked with them back to their ghetto apartment, merely a block from the huge synagogue.
"We need pictures, and they need to be official quality," Ava murmured.
Mario nodded once, understanding immediately what she was referring to.
"We will get them to the printer. He will add them to the passes so he can stamp the picture when he stamps the pass. It makes it more complicated, but it is the only way to keep them authentic. We can add your fingerprints and signatures when we have the passes, but we need the pictures as soon as possible."
Angelo was being impossibly close-lipped about his maneuverings, refusing Ava's help at every turn. He was determined to keep her tucked in the convent and out of harm's way, but she was slowly going crazy, She knew the Soninos were on the bottom of a very long list of those in need of false identity cards, so she decided to make them her responsibility.
I have them,
Mario said softly.